We'll start by our singing Wondrous Love, page 8 on our songbook. Page 8, Wondrous Love. Could we all stand up, please? Candle today to Father Carney, in memory of Father Carney. Unfortunately, in history, our prophets are generally killed or repressed or completely forgotten. So I think it's appropriate to try to remember, at least for a short while, our modern-day prophet, Father Carney. We'll start with two readings. The first is from the Bible, from the book of Luke.
And Jesus came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and he went to the synagogue, as his custom was, on the Sabbath day. And he stood up to read, and there was given to him the book of the prophet Isaiah. He opened the book and found the place where it was written. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set liberty those who are oppressed.
And the next is a reading from Father Carney.
To love Christ really is to try and live as he lived. If I love the poor as Christ did, then I too, freely become one of them, live with them, share their lives, besides trying to use my talents to help and teach them. To live as a comfortable, well-dressed, bourgeoisie white person is okay, I guess. But it's not my kind of life, and it's not what Christ did. He freely chose to become one of the masses of the poor people in the world. He tore into those who held the poor in bondage. He cursed them and said, "Woe to you, hypocrites, to you priests, and to you rich, who are honored and accepted by the world." And he was killed for them.
Last quote is a saying among the Honduran Indians: "No one listens to the cry of the poor or the sound of a wooden bell." Well, this is the second in our series of Eight Who Dared. Next week, we're going to have sort of a group participatory service on Barbara Savage, the woman who pedaled around the world on a bicycle, including Morocco, so you'll have to come. We have a Peace Corps person from Morocco here. I guess compared to last week, we can say we're going from the ridiculous to the sublime. This service is about a person who dared, a person most of us probably have never heard of, and I didn't until I read his book about a year ago. It's a service about a love affair of a person who had a love affair with the poor people, especially the campesinos of a small Central American banana republic, Honduras. It's a service about Father James Guadalupe Carney, a Catholic priest, a modern-day saint, who through many experiences slowly was transformed from an ordinary Jesuit priest to a revolutionary. So I'd like to tell you the story of Jim Carney, interspersed with some Latin American music. We'll begin with a little song called Lament del Indio, the Lament of the Indian. And I'll like you to hear an English translation of some of the words.
The plowed fields, the planted soil, the harvest, and his love bring mirth to the Indio in this world, in spite of his sadness. Wherever he may go, he sadly plays his rondador, because in his heart there is but sorrow and pain. Thank you.
Who was Jim Carney? His background was very ordinary for an extraordinary person who became a nonconformist and a rebel. His parents were middle-class people from Milwaukee. His father worked for the Burroughs Machine Company, and he traveled around quite a bit, and they moved quite a bit. During the Depression, Carney's father was a great supporter of Father Coughlin. Those oldies in our group will remember Father Coughlin was this demagogic priest who accused Roosevelt and the New Deal of being communistic. Jim's mother was a nice, pleasant, but undistinguished woman. Jim was born in Chicago in 1924, and his family shortly after moved to St. Louis. Jim's entire education, from grade school, high school, seminary, was entirely within a Catholic environment. He was raised in a totally Catholic world. Every day he got up at 5:30, went to Mass like a good young Catholic. As a youngster, he delivered newspapers. He was a golf caddy. At high school, he excelled in athletics. He was on the basketball and baseball and tennis and football teams. He attended dances. He had girlfriends. And in general, he had a nice, normal, happy childhood. He was very fun-loving, very popular, but he took his Catholicism very seriously. And he's very much concerned about not sinning, which is very typical among Catholics. Except, even in high school, his attitude towards sinning was different from the average Catholic. Most Catholics, I presume, are afraid of sinning for fear of going to hell. Jim didn't want to sin because he felt it would offend God's wishes. To him, God, Jesus, was this wonderful creature who loved everyone unstintingly. God was the one who allowed him to become a good athlete, to get good grades in school, and it was the height of ingratitude to go against God's wishes by sinning. Jim also developed early on, I don't know how he developed this, but a different attitude toward God, how to relate to God. Most religious people, well, at least most Catholics, believe that if there's something you want, you pray to God. And if you're a good Catholic, most likely God will give you what you want. Jim was very puzzled by this attitude. For example, his novitiate would prepare one day for a hike and a picnic, and they'd all pray to the Virgin Mary for no rain. And he observed a mile or two away, there'd be a Catholic farmer in the field who'd be praying for rain. Or when he played for Central Catholic High School, he noticed that everyone on his side, the team, the student body, the nurses, the nuns, the priests, they're all saying three Hail Marys for the victory of Central Catholic against La Salle, another Catholic team. And everyone on the other side was praying, hailing three Hail Marys in order to win. In a more grimmer mood, years later, 1969, he noticed a newspaper article showing a Salvadorian bishop. This was during a war between El Salvador and Honduras. This bishop blessing the pilots of bombing planes who were about to fly over Honduras and drop bombs. The other hand, everyone in Honduras was blessing their troops to murder and kill El Salvadorian soldiers. So after a while, Jim convinced himself that God does not intervene in mundane human affairs. However, God, and he uses the word God and Jesus interchangeable, God is the one that gives everyone the potentiality to strive for truth and justice. And later on, he developed sort of a Hegelian notion, a dialectical notion of God, that God is the spirit that through permitting conflicting ideologies to clash, ultimately there will emerge the classless society of a paradise on earth. So instead of asking God to solve his problems, Jim got to believe an old Spanish motto which says, "A Dios regando con el mazo dando." Anyone know Spanish here? Could translate that?
God will give you what your hands do.
Right. Or more literally, to God pray, but strike with a hammer. Jim felt that his first real breakthrough occurred when he was inducted into the Army in 1940. Before his induction, he described himself as a typical middle-class gringo. He had prejudices against Protestants, Jews, atheists. Seemed to make a new man of him, as the Army often does, sometimes in a negative way. For example, in the Army, for the first time, he was taken out of his Catholic world. He said the Holy Spirit began the long, slow process of transforming me into a genuine Christian. His attitude toward the war differed from his fellow troops. He became a pacifist. To him, the Bible said, "Thou shalt not kill, all men are brothers," and he just refused. He said to himself he would never shoot anybody. He resented the attitude that the radio, the press, the GI movies had of the enemy troops, portraying Germans as always big-headed brutes, as Japanese as little monkeys, as the Italians as ridiculous fools. He also didn't like the system of segregation between officers and men, officers getting better privileges, better food, and so on. So he decided not to salute officers. And he did it by pretending not to see them. But they caught on to his ruse, and he wound up once in jail for about 3 days for not saluting an officer. Also, for the first time in the Army, he had an experience very similar to mine in sort of a convoluted way. I was raised in Brooklyn, and practically all my friends were either liberal or leftists. And leftists, they were either Stalinists or Trotskyites or Lovestonites and so on. So in the Army, for the first time, I met a Republican, believe it or not. Connie, for the first time, met an agnostic, an atheist. And to his astonishment, he discovered that many of these non-believers were generous and behaved more like Christians than his fellow Catholics. For the first time, he observed extreme poverty. He was stationed in southern France, and he visited a camp of Algerians who were in this refugee camp. And he was horrified by what he saw, at the poverty, at the disease, kids with swollen bellies eating out of garbage cans. And he compared this with a trip he took to Rome, where he saw the richness and medieval pomp of the Pope being carried into St. Peter's Cathedral on the shoulders of 8 people. He compared this with Christ's disciples, didn't have shoes to wear, and Christ preaching, "Give up your possessions and join me." Later, he was to more deeply realize how the church hierarchy was polluted by wealth and power, and how the church taught the poor that they always will be poor, and taught the rich that they are always will be rich, and they deserve to be rich. After the war, on the GI Bill, he decided to study civil engineering and again went back to a Catholic school, the University of Detroit. During the summer, he worked on the assembly line in an auto plant in Detroit, and here he was very much influenced by Marxist literature. People gave him pamphlets of Marx and Engels. Engels was writing that the church is in the hands of the controlling rich people, and the church tends to foster and perpetuate the ruling class. At that time, he didn't understand this. It was only later, in experiences in Honduras, did he realize what Engels meant. He became involved in the auto union and began admiring communists, who he felt were very courageous, were fighting for justice, while many of the union leaders were as conservative and as pro-U.S. foreign policy as Republicans. While at the University of Detroit, he's very influenced by the movie Lost Horizons with Ronald Coleman. Ronald Coleman was an ex-British soldier who decided to search for truth in the world. And he lived with coal miners in France, with businessmen, with students. And Ronald Coleman discovered that people just professed their Christianity, that very few people really lived like Christ. And it all seemed to be very hypocritical. Connie very much identified with Ronald Coleman in this movie, and he began thinking of becoming a missionary. He read an article in a Jesuit journal of a missionary, a Jesuit missionary in a town called Toro, Honduras, riding on horseback, visiting remote villages, embracing emaciated children, helping them fight disease. And this seemed to become his model. He very much wanted to be that. And one day he announced to his fiancée that he's going to become a missionary, to her great horror. She broke into tears. She was hysterical. But he felt a marriage would encumber his plans. So he applied and was accepted to the novitiate of the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits in Missouri. At his Jesuit college, he renewed his strong belief in God and Christ. But unlike the other Jesuits, who focused on overcoming sin, his focus was on helping the poor. He wanted to be like Jesus, who he called the poor campesino from Nazareth, who lived among the poor, not having a place of his own, unlike a bird with its nest and a fox with its cave. The essence of Christianity to Carney was turn away from material possessions, live with, and help the poor. And he was proud of the fact that a number of priests of his novitiate who trained with him ultimately wound up in Nicaragua after the Sandinistas took control and were very helpful in the literacy campaign, helping to eliminate disease. A number of his priest friends were murdered by the Contras in Nicaragua. He's also drawn to Gandhi. He's drawn to nonviolence at this time, and he became aware that a non-Christian could also, that the Holy Spirit also worked among non-Christians. Well, it's a little break. I'd like to play another Latin American melody. This is an instrumental melody called Amares Ayares. Thank you. Well, after he was completed Jesuit school, he was assigned for 3 years to Belize, which is a small country in Central America, formerly called British Honduras. There, he immediately began living with the poor, dressing like the poor. For example, he even began smoking secretly because the peasants smoked. He helped the peasants form coffee cooperatives. He swore never to wear fancy clothes, never to wear a necktie, or even to shine his shoes. In contrast to most of what he called the middle-class gringo priests, who he accused of living in luxury or drinking fancy wines and eating good food and wearing nice clothes, he felt he was going to live like a campesino. He also chided his fellow priests for not learning the Carib language of the Indians. One day, on a leave of absence, he visited the Basilica of the Guadalupe Cathedral outside of Mexico City. He's very much enamored with the story of what occurred there. Several hundred years ago, a peasant called Juan Diego lost his cloak in the field. And when he discovered his cloak, there, imprinted on the cloak, was a picture of the Virgin Mary. And the Virgin Mary was an Indian woman. So they built this cathedral on the site where the cloak was. Father Connie just liked the idea that Jesus and his mother were identified with the lowly Indian. And as a result, he changed his name to Padre Guadalupe. So from then on, he's Padre Guadalupe. He finally got transferred to the small village in Honduras, a village called Yoro, where he saw read that interesting article of the priest riding on a horse to the different villages. And he tried to live like that. He refused to wear a clerical garb, despite the insistence of superiors. He wore ordinary clothes with a crucifix around his neck. Each morning he'd take off and visit these remote villages, and he'd live, sleep with the villagers. However, the conditions often were so terrible that he couldn't even sleep in their huts. Their huts were filled with disease-ridden rats, cockroaches, scorpions, and he would sleep on the floor or bench of the local church or school. He discovered that 90% of the villagers were illiterate. Their average pay was about $100 a year. He was also very popular playing the guitar to the young folks in the town plazas, and he sang masses in Spanish. And he spent less and less time giving communion and more time helping the villagers eliminate disease and improving their living conditions, which, as I say, were terrible. Tuberculosis was rampant. The water was polluted. They drank water in which dogs and pigs defecated. Water wasn't boiled. Children ran around naked or worked all day in the fields. One day, as a naive priest, he went to a town, and the owner of a new hotel asked him to bless the hotel, which was going to open in a day or so. But the hotel was in a disreputable part of town. And Connie said, "Are you sure this is not a brothel?" Mm-hmm. And the owner said, "Oh no, this is going to be the most respectable hotel in town." So he entered the hotel. There was a big picture of the Sacred Heart in the entranceway. And he went from room to room, spraying holy water in each of the rooms. Then 2 days later, it opened up as the big brothel, big whorehouse in town. And whenever Connie would pass his whorehouse, he would hurl curses at it. But no matter how sharp the curses were, the whorehouse prospered more and more. So his consciousness kept developing. He discovered that 80% of humanity is undernourished and poor, while the United States, which is 6% of humanity, consumes about one half of its goods. In Honduras, for example, the three main products are bananas, coffee, and cattle. And the bananas we eat often come from Honduras, of which the Honduran peasant gets next to nothing. The same is true with the coffee. Most of the profit goes to the American marketeer. Or the land on which the cattle graze very often was stolen from the peasant, or the peasant had to give up because he couldn't pay his debt. At the same time, U.S. companies paid practically no taxes to the Honduran government. So to Carney, the greatest sin of all was American imperialism. And that was the sin that we should fight against. There are segments of the Jews in Jesus' time were known as zealots. One of Jesus' disciples was Simon the Zealot. And the wealthiest segments of the Jewry accused these groups of being against the government, proclaiming Christ the King, and as a result they were turned over to the Roman authorities. Christ was crucified. Carney felt that nowadays, if Christ wandered around in Honduras, it would be the CIA and the U.S. government that would be organizing the squads that would kill him. Father Carney became drawn to a movement called communitarianism or Christian socialism that both rejected U.S. capitalism and Soviet communism. It was known as the Third Way. And the stress they put was on equitable distribution of wealth through cooperatives, improving peasants' participation in digging wells, building schools, demanding human rights. There'd be a mixed economy of state ownership and small private owners. And apparently this is what the Sandinistas attempted to do in Nicaragua, except the Sandinistas achieved this through violent means rather than peaceful, nonviolent means that this Third Way group recommended. Father Carney once visited the home of a millionaire landowner who began taking away the land that he had rented to his campesinos. And Carney asked, "Why are you doing this? Don't you have enough money?" And the landowner said, "Padre Guadalupe, you know as well as I do that money is God. And I just want to make more money." A few years later, this millionaire died. Apparently, he didn't take his God with him. So, Father Carney was a supporter of the Third Way, busy raising the consciousness of peasants that the biggest sin is poverty and undernourishment, not the usual Catholic sins. He began turning away from the notion of the democratic way toward achieving the Christian socialist society. He observed in Honduras what appeared in many parts of the Third World, for example, under Marcos, as we all know, where the elections were a complete farce. Everyone was corrupted. Ballots weren't counted. If there was any danger of a leftist party being elected, the army, with U.S. help, simply established a dictatorship, and that was the end of democracy for a while. And the turning point was when Allende was assassinated. Allende was elected democratically, and Father Carney got convinced that it was an illusion to expect to overturn these wealthy landowners through democratic means. Just was not possible. A number of his campesino friends were murdered who tried to have good elections. Nuns and priests also were murdered who tried to police polling booths. They were arrested, harassed, and a few of them were murdered. So he became convinced that to love one's neighbor, you have to resort to armed struggle for the liberation of the poor. Instead of turning the other cheek, he favored the peasants fighting back. So he finally found a convergence of Marxism and Christianity in his version of liberation theology. I can't go into this whole field of liberation theology, but to mention two of the leading leaders of this movement. One was Gustavo Gutierrez, a Peruvian intellectual, and another was Camilo Torres. The two of them were students at a Catholic university in Belgium. And when they graduated, they went to Latin American countries. They both hoped for the same aims, for a socialistic type of mixed economy. But Guterres still favored peaceful means. Torres pretty much was like Father Carney. He joined a guerrilla group at the age of 37, and in no time at all, he was killed. In protest against the United States' role in Honduras and elsewhere, Carney ceased to become a U.S. citizen and declared himself, by himself, a Honduran citizen. But Honduras didn't like him as a Honduras citizen, so they shoved him on a plane and transported him back to Miami. There, he volunteered to go to Guatemala to replace two murdered priests, but the church decided that that area was just too dangerous, and they withdrew all their priests and nuns. He was assigned to Nicaragua, where he claimed he spent the two happiest years of his life. That's where he wrote his autobiography, To Be a Revolutionary. It's a really terrific book. I don't know whether the public library has it. I got it out of the university library. There he observed at first hand the atrocities of the Contras. Finally, he got his wishes. He got back, sneaked back into Honduras, and he joined a guerrilla band as the priest of this guerrilla band. And in order to do so, he had to leave the Society of Jesus, of Jesuits, because they don't allow such activity in the society. In 1982, at the age of 58, he joined this band, and a few months later, he disappeared. He became one of the disappeared ones. The Spanish name is Los Desaparecidos. Do you know a better pronunciation? It means the disappeared ones. We're familiar with these disappeared ones in El Salvador and Argentina. His parents from St. Louis spent many months down in Honduras trying to find out what happened. They got very little cooperation from the State Department or the Honduran government, who claimed that he probably died of malnutrition in the woods. He spoke to several captured guerrillas who were later killed by the Honduran authorities, who surmised that he was either caught and tortured and killed or died of malnutrition in a jail. But nobody knows what happened to Father Carney. He just became one of the disappeared ones. I'm going to play one more Latin American piece called El Palomo, and I'd like you to hear what the words of the song say. El Palomo means the dove.
There was a dove flying in the sky. The hunter came and stopped his flight. Mortally wounded, the dove gave up. The cruel hunter shot him in the back. The dove, sad mate, flew through the hills looking for the wounded dove, sad and inconsolable. Sparrows, songbirds, and hummingbirds came all united to break through the pain. All the birds together cry out with the people, is he dead or alive? Answer us now.
Su pueblo, herido de muerte.
reference the story of Padre Guadalupe, the friend of the lowly and the poor in Central America. Well, we should have a few minutes for any questions or discussion.
Will you tell us a bit more about his relations with the authorities and the church? I mean, evidently, he never really rebelled. I mean, he just withdrew, but, and even when he was in Nicaragua, he evidently was in good terms, from what you said.
From what I've read in his book, apparently he was a very likable person. Apparently he expressed his rebelliousness in a way that didn't offend people. But he was constantly at odds with his superiors. For example, he objected in Honduras that the nuns had a swimming pool. But he's very pleased when the pool developed a crack. In other words, he felt, if you have a pool, build one for the peasants as well, you see. He was always aware of injustice. And I guess he is more of an irritant to them. They tolerated him. And the fact that he's willing to go to these dangerous places is perfectly okay. But at the same time, there were many other priests who were similar to him or variations of him. So this was not unusual. This is my guess.
Whom you sat very well today when you think about Father Curran, the little girl of 10 or 11 who was turned out of high school. I think the church goes in spells in terms of when it decides to clamp down. For whatever reason, it may have decided that it was safer to let him do what little harm from their perspective in terms of the authority he was doing than to make an issue of him. When they decide to make an issue, they start.
And I imagine they must have realized how successful he was with these poor people, you know, living with them. And they probably tolerated his idiosyncrasies because he converted, genuinely converted a lot of peasants to Catholicism, his version of Catholicism, which the church likes. So they will forgive the fact that you didn't wear a clerical collar when you're on horseback in a little village. I think you might know more about these things than I do. Yes?
I didn't quite understand what happened with his fiancée. And did he find some women who would go with him on these social adventures, or did he spend his life alone?
Alone. He was a regular guy, engaged, fell in love with this woman, engaged to get married, but I guess his love affair with Jesus and the poor, and his wish to be a missionary became greater. And he told her this, that he couldn't do what he wanted to be and be married at the same time. So they broke up. But I'm not aware of his involvement with any, amorous or romantic involvement with any woman after that.
Is liberation theology the primarily Roman Catholic movement that does include other? And in a sense, what exactly means liberation to what or from what?
Well, I think, I don't know too much about its origin, but in Vatican II in 1962, they passed a number of resolutions which proclaimed the equality of the bishops and the priests and the laity, something quite new. They also stressed the need to be of help to the poor. Liberation theology is generally a Christian socialist movement that stresses that the poor are perhaps the holiest. Jesus was the one who lived among the poor. Priests should do the same. And by liberating the poor, you might set up some sort of Marxian, socialistic, whatever you might call it, society. I'm sure there are many variations of this. Now, can anyone comment on the other aspect of a question about other religious groups?
And there's a wide group of Protestants in, first of all, it is a Latin American movement, and part of the reason so I identify with the Catholic Church is because all of Latin America is Catholic. I mean, overwhelmingly, 80-90%. But there's a large pool of, if you read a magazine called Christianity in Crisis, which is an Iberian, Reinhold Niebuhr, magazine, which comes out of Union Theological in New York, there's a large body of Protestant theologians who are into liberation theology. In terms of the phrase that you use about trying to identify liberation theology, it'd be summarized in the biblical phrase, "When do we see you, Lord? We see you in the least of your brethren," was Jesus' response. And that's kind of a hard phrase. The other thing is that liberation theology speaks to, what's interesting about it is it's a convergence of the social gospel of Christians with Marxism. They're both very eschatological insofar as the social message, or they both appeal to another world, a world into the future. And there's a difference between the two. The Marxism is more materialism or more materialistic, but they have a lot of very similar themes philosophically. And that's why there's such a crossover, and that's why the Pope recently has reacted so strongly against it, because they are so similar, he's tried to cut the line and say, this is what Christianity is, and this is what Marxism is. He's been frightened of it because they're so identifiable.
I know no country in the world has as large a proportion of priests and nuns in the government as the Sandinistas.
In the years before World War II, there was a Japanese person who lived quite a similar life, Toyohiko Kagawa. He came from a middle-class Japanese family. I think his parents were rather well-to-do. And he eventually lived in the slums and started a social center and did many of these kinds of things. He was a pacifist, but during the war, I don't know just what happened to him, but apparently he kind of made his peace with the Japanese government. And I don't know how long he lived, either throughout the war or afterward, but your story of Father Kearney reminds me very much of Kagawa.
Yeah, I'm sure there are many unsung other heroes like Father Carney that we don't know about. Rick, just let me know when we should. No. Okay. Dick?
I find the story of Father Carney deeply touching and very tragic, because it seems to me that he became a dark reflection of that which he opposed. He began from a position of helping the campesinos in a loving and nonviolent way, with the intent to make their lot better than it had been. He wound up as a revolutionary, sanctioning and employing the very violence he sought to oppose, and encouraging a battle in which all but the very rich, those he opposed, became poorer. And that's the tragedy of the revolutionary, the violent Marxist revolutionary approach to solving the world's problems. I don't myself see an answer to that, but I can't accept that answer.
Rosemary. I want to let Metra.
If Rome sent replacements for him and his presence turned away from the church after he died, does that come?
I really don't know. Rosemary.
And then if you ever play a simulation game called Star Wars, response to what Duke just said and the inevitability of people with the best of intentions.
intention starting out one way and becoming another. This is a game that people who work with human relations go into groups, try to straighten out problems or houses or confrontations used to show what happens to human beings in given situations. I had worked with the Department of Extension years ago and worked with these materials a lot, but I had never played the game, so I knew what the game was. Well, the other day I was in a class where the teacher had to stay 2.5 hours and play the game. And it's quite an experience, even knowing what it's about and what is going to happen. You start out with certain material things and you trade to try to improve your situation. And at the end of a certain period of time, points are counted and people are divided into groups. And they're labeled. Then you do this again, do it 2 or 3 times. And finally, the people on top are given the power to make the rules. And what happens to the people, quote, on the bottom, unquote, is that they rebel. And it's a marvelous simulation of what happens when people get power and other people try hard and can't. And you can have great discussions about whether it's luck or upbringing or whatever. But the interesting thing is what happens to human beings. And it's fascinating and very frightening to watch. And it suggests that in a situation, a life situation, when this kind of thing happens, this is how people will react. And they do it again and again and again. Mm-hmm.
Well, someone has once said that revolutions are caused by revolting conditions. Sometimes conditions are so terrible that people are driven to extreme measures. And one of my objections to U.S. foreign policy is we see Marxism, communism, as all one thing. I feel there are many communisms. And I think Nicaragua was attempting a variety of a non-Stalinistic type of socialism with a large religious overtone. We have converted the whole thing into a conflict between Russia and America. So instead of accepting a pluralistic attitude toward different kinds of governments around the world, we label a government in an extreme way and we do everything in our power to make them behave the way we label them. Tom?
The tragedy I see in the personality that you have presented today is that he's failed. But there's a lot of similarity in his life and that of Jesus, of Nazareth, who eventually succeeded, but only because a few years after his death, a very powerful figure was converted to his way of thinking. And then, I think Christianity became as violent as anything else that tended to supersede. And therein lies success, where you become violent.
Yeah. Yes.
It's one thing to debate philosophically communism and imperialism, if that's the name you want to put on it. But it's a different thing if you try to live it. There are many people in the world who, in fact, almost everyone in the world will revolt at a certain point if they're pushed far enough. What your example brings out is someone who was measured and among us and then descended into the very bottom class and along the way picked up the natural inclination to revolt and it could send the messages back to us. What I'm saying is that if you push someone far enough, they will become violent. I would in most of us would. And so this is not an exceptional thing that he became that way. I think it's a natural thing.
Jim.
I want to respond to Dick because I think what you said is really intriguing to me. Many of you I might know that I worked in Latin America for 3 summers and 40 college years, kind of a Peace Corps type program in a very poor area. And what I found, one of my experiences was you do get absorbed in the situation. If you go there with the intent to live the lifestyle of the people, I was living in very similar conditions as you described, essentially 16th century life, electricity, plumbing, etc. When you see little kids eating dirt, when you see maggots eating living flesh in people, when you see people die from the most simple things of worms, breech birth, etc. When you just see children who have one set of clothes and their rags and that's the only set of clothes, when you see massive tuberculosis, and if you at all identify with that, you become absorbed in it. When I'd come back after the summer, I'd come back to, because I was in the seminary at the time, come back to this really luxurious ground, and a lot of wealth, and I couldn't, I'd hear Spanish music, and I couldn't eat food. And because you get absorbed in a certain thing, that reminds, kind of behavioristic thing, and you hear something that stimulates it, and all of a sudden it brings you back to these strong images. And so, but at the same time, you know, things you were saying, you know, like, it's really easy. The situation of how people live in rural Latin America, especially, it's terribly violent in itself. It's what Bishop Tutu has been saying. He said, you tell us that, you know, withdrawal of funds will be terrible. He said, it's terrible for us right now. The violence, we are living the violence. So what if there's 500 or 1,000 are killed in South Africa? And I think that the circumstances, as you mentioned and summarized, as you just, in your last statements, I think that's so true. And if I, you know, I try to describe, sometimes I've tried to describe my experiences, and people just don't understand it. Until you go away, you know, I recommend to people, they go to Central America or to a place such as that, and go off, get away from the big cities. Go off to where most of the people live, or many people live in the countryside. And if you get absorbed in that, I mean, it's appalling.
Yeah. In general, Dick, I agree with you, except I don't agree with a formula, if you make a formula out of what you are saying. Let me give you an example. When Ruth and I were in the British Isles, we took a bus to the Rob Roy country in Scotland. This is a very nice bus, traveling through this green country. And on the bus, we made the acquaintance of guess who, but a Dutch Jewish couple who were on tour in Scotland. They lived in Connecticut. And when they talked to us, they were in a concentration camp called Sobibor, one of these extermination camps. And they joined a group that had captured machine guns, rifles. About 500 Jews fought their way out, about 50 survived. These people were very gentle, very passive, pacifistic sort of Jews. There are some situations in which you feel driven toward violence as a hope. Unfortunately, the hopes are crushed by stronger violent forces. But there is always this hope in a totally desperate situation that violence might possibly get you out of the situation. So I wouldn't apply a rigid formula that we should never resort the violence. After all, we fought against the Nazis in World War II. Yeah, one more question from Bob.
We wouldn't have a country if we hadn't gone through a revolution.
Yeah, right.
Okay. One more. There's a picture this morning in the New York Times of President Aquino making a truce agreement with a growing Catholic priest in northern Luzon. He had started working with the communists, but then put it off to lead his own revolutionary movement.